Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith.
Now, without further ado, I would like to bring on Christy Lanternman, LPC. She counsels couples and adult individuals recovering from religious trauma. She focused on her graduate study on how religious trauma occurs, religious abuse, and how to identify controlling groups of people. Oh, and how folks can recover from religious trauma. She is passionate about supporting her clients and their healing process. Christy, I am so excited to have you on here. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to talk about this topic.
So what kind of got you into wanting to learn about purity culture? Because for me, I kind of experienced it, and it was just something I went through. Everybody went through. I didn't give it a second thought. What was the triggering thing that made you kind of identify this is something need to be talked about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in grad school, I did take as many opportunities to look at religious trauma as possible. And over again, purity culture came up as a big piece of that harmful indoctrination that can sometimes happen in these harmful high demand religions, specifically in the 80s and 90s in the evangelical church. And it was very familiar to me. I didn't have a word for it until, you know, I had studied some of these concepts in grad school, and it became very validating, very eye-opening, very helpful for me to learn about it and to discover resources out there that can help folks recover and be their most whole sexual erotic being that they want to be.
That is super interesting. I'm jealous that you studied that in grad school. I'm rethinking my whole series of studies now. And, you know, speaking of that, you know, as a non-binary person, as well as a owner of a vagina, I definitely, you know, experienced purity culture and have found that over the years, a lot of things that I run into and unpack, I realized this came from some of the purity culture teachings. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us, like, what are some of the concepts that people might've been exposed to that they would be, you know, having these impacts from?
Yeah. So some of the core concepts in purity culture, one of the primary ones that you're alluding to is this only allowing for heterosexual monogamous type relationships. And so any purity is synonymous with sameness. And sameness means we have this heterosexual monogamous mold that we all need to strive and attain for. And anything outside of that, especially any sort of sexual activity or exploring oneself or self-pleasuring or masturbation before marriage is harmful, is sinful, is going to lead you to many evil, bad choices and distance from God and potentially open yourself up to these diseases, very harmful fear-based tactics around this heteronormative mold that was promoted as the ultimate way to behave and to be and to identify, with marriage being that ultimate accomplishment, like that ultimate thing that you're heading towards and saving yourself for. So that's one of them. And also, you know, a lot of push towards that nuclear family expression and real strong traditional gender roles are all within that concept alone. And then another one that's probably well more known in purity culture is that dating is discouraged and courtship is encouraged. And so there's this overemphasis on any physical interaction or lack thereof with the opposite sex. So, you know, in youth groups, it was common to only give side hugs to your brethren in Christ. I apologize for all the gender languages. And I was in such a conservative culture that we didn't have dances, but I have heard that some people that had dances, you had to have room for the Holy Spirit in between you and your dance partner. So very big emphasis on like physical interactions and really shaming anything that was beyond, you know, a handshake or a side hug or, and then of course, the way that dating was discouraged was this outward commitment to waiting for marriage with things like purity rings, pledge cards and balls. And so I'm kind of getting to the phrase here. Yes, Glenda has her pledge card from public school, which is just mind blowing with, yes, it's just pretty scary that this is happening in public schools as well. So, you know, my personal experience comes from, I went to a private Christian school. And so I just figured that a lot of these experiences were from private Christian evangelical contexts. But to kind of back up for a minute in terms of how this happened, since 1981, there's been $2 billion spent in federal funding, more than $2 billion that has been allocated to abstinent-only education programs.
The government has spent mm-hmm. $2 billion in mm-hmm. the last, what, 40 years on its citizens not having sex before marriage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this was sort of legalized in 1988. The Supreme Court passed what's called the Adolescent Family Life Act. So AFLA is known as the chastity bill. And the chastity bill is supposed to promote self-discipline in adolescence. So it's the most common justification for these abstinent-only programs. And the curriculum endorses purity culture. It also endorses victim blaming towards assigned females at birth for any sort of sexual and also non-consensual sexual situations, and also endorses STI stigmatization. So really, really harmful messages being funded by our government in public school system through this AFLA Act.
What do you mean victim blaming? I heard some pretty technical terms, but what do you mean more specifically about victim blaming for women?
Mm-hmm. Victim blaming. So another concept of purity culture is this idea that girls are to be modest, both in dress and in behavior. And they are responsible for whether or not their brethren stumble or find them physically attractive. And may, you know, they need to sort of behave in a way that reduces that from happening. And boys are thought to be these sort of uncontrollable sexual beings. And the way that we help them. And again, these are all just concepts in purity culture. Like I'm laughing because it's just ridiculous to say it out loud, and how binary it is and how shaming it is and how harmful it is. And so, you know, women were supposed to behave in these ways so that boys don't stumble. And then the emphasis on boys was really abstaining from masturbation and porn and sexually stimulating material, and doing this through accountability groups and, you know, weekly sort of meetings where we talk about, you know, what have you looked at? What have you not looked at? Have we stayed pure? So the way that victim blaming comes in is that when something does happen, and, you know, say some teenagers have sex, or say, God forbid, like there's been something non-consensual happening, a lot of times the first question is towards the assigned female at birth, saying, well, what were you wearing? Mm. Or did you have anything to drink? And so the assumption is that it's the vulva owner's responsibility for there not to be any sex until marriage. So that's what I mean with victim blaming.
I went to a private school and they did have like a dress code. And I do recall some teachers pulling out a ruler and kind of measuring, I don't remember what it was, like how high above the knee the dress was or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that kind of fits into it too, and results of purity culture.
Yep, absolutely.
And isn't that something that still goes on? I mean, aren't we still hearing, you know, all the time about girls being sent home from school because of their, you know, they're wearing the spaghetti strap shirt mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. It seems mm-hmm. like these ideas have lingered and are still with us. Would you say that's coming out of this purity culture still?
Oh, absolutely. There is this recent viral post about all these girls' school photos being photoshopped.
Yes.
Because there was some like minor cleavage, like very normal, like, I mean, even if it was like full on cleavage, like it's again, that's where this victim blaming comes in, is that women or vulva owners need to hide their bodies and hide their curves because they're responsible for other people's thoughts or thinking or behaviors, for goodness sakes. And so, yeah, I do think that comes from purity culture.
It sounds like the phrase boys will be boys kind of abdicates them from any responsibility, because I never hear something like girls will be girls. Mm-hmm. I rarely hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I also want to talk about how damaging that is for assigned males at birth, because to assume that they are just naturally very high desired sexualized beings, you know, then sort of they can feel shame and stigmatization when maybe they do have lower desire, or maybe they actually identify as asexual, or maybe they get into a relationship where they're not ready to have sex and they're kind of wanting, maybe they're a demisexual and they need more things to build in that relationship. And then, you know, but they're expected to just want sex all the time and to have sex, you know, on whenever, you know, is their partner's wanting to. And so they can also experience shame on the flip side of that. But yes, to back to your point, that saying boys will be boys does kind of excuse some behaviors that could be non-consensual. And that goes back to that abstinent-only education, where when we have abstinent-only education, we're not talking about sex or consent. You know, consent is an enthusiastic yes. Mm. If we don't know what consent is, then how do we know if we're getting it or not? And then we're getting into these situations where, you know, people are not giving an enthusiastic yes, and then, you know, people are getting really hurt. And we also, in abstinent-only education, we don't have... we're not talking about anatomy. We're not talking about really important sexual health information and really important sexual health practices, because the assumption is that you're just going to wait until you get married and you will be a virgin and your spouse will be a virgin. And then, you know, you can have at it and you're going to have sort of the best sex of your life. It's just going to magically happen on your wedding night somehow. Because you waited. There's this idea that if you wait, it makes the sex better, which we find often is not the case. Because we haven't explored, especially for vulva owners, we haven't explored our body, because we've been told that our body is evil, it's the flesh, it's sinful, pleasure's bad, to be Christ-like is to suffer. And so any sort of pleasure is bad. So we don't masturbate, we don't explore, we don't make out with our partners, we don't access that erotic being, which is very, very normal to access throughout adolescence. And then all of a sudden we get married and we expect something to happen and it doesn't happen, and we're very confused and we're very traumatized by it too.
You know, that's such a good point that you brought up about, you know, it's not just the lack of other sex education, lack of learning about consent, lack of learning about, you know, how sex even works. But I know a lot of people that I know, as well as myself included, when we came of age or whatever and got married, there was this idea that, kind of like you mentioned earlier, well, men are always ready for sex, but women kind of don't really like it. It's something that you just have to suffer through. It's your duty to give this to your husband, whether you're enjoying it or not. And if you're not, you know, that's more Christ-like. I wonder if you could talk about some of the ways that people experience negative outcomes from that messaging.
It's such a good point. So in the book Pure, by Linda K. Klein, if you haven't read that book and you've been negatively impacted by purity culture and you're a vulva owner, please read that book. She did a qualitative study and interviewed a bunch of assigned females at birth about their experience in purity culture. And some of them reported this idea to be Christ-like is to suffer, and that it is your marital duty to keep your husband satiated or satisfied sexually. And some of them had been told that one of the most godly things a woman can do is to be submit to being raped in their marriage. It's just shocking that some vulva owners have been told this in these contexts. Wow. Like, I mean, even just to say that out loud. And I have a colleague who, she and I specialize in religious trauma, especially in purity culture. And she has a family member who was actually given a contract that when she got married, she was supposed to sign a contract to say that she will not withhold sex from her husband for any reason. Showed me a picture. Yeah, for any reason. Yeah. So clearly, you know, not only lack of education of sex, but promotion of non-consensual activities that are highly traumatizing for any gender, you know, but especially vulva owners or assigned females at birth who these kind of messages are really pointed towards.
Wow. So I'm just kind of digesting that. That's, you know, I'm on the other side of it. I kind of felt like, I felt exactly what Kara was saying. Like, okay, us guys, we're always supposed to want to have sex. And the women don't. They don't like it as much as the guys do. And I've since obviously learned that was wrong. But I always felt weird, kind of, entering into a sexual relationship with someone because, like, well, you don't really like this, but thanks for letting me do this.
Yeah. So just really, it kind of creates like freeze in the body, right? Like, and to access your erotic being, you need curiosity and you need playfulness and you need comfort and enjoyment and an exchange of energies. And yet these messages aim to freeze your sexuality. Like, sex is bad. Don't have it. When you're married, it's okay, but don't, you know? And so it just like, it creates freeze in the body. And then all of a sudden you deconstruct it or you walk away from the lifestyle and then you do want to engage sexually, or say you get married and you're still within this mindset. And then we're expected to share these pieces of ourselves when we have been told for decades that it's bad, sinful, and evil. And so it has like major impacts on people's ability to be intimate and to access their eroticism. And it can last for a long time if untreated.
Yeah, I could tell you it definitely has killed my curiosity and playfulness. 100%. It's I hate to say it, but I'm still working to try and get past that, and I've been out of it for over a decade.
It definitely takes time.
That's something that I experienced as well, where even after I had decided, okay, I'm rejecting these narratives from purity culture, mentally that didn't automatically translate into my body doing what I wanted.
So one of the leading authors in the mental health community on trauma, Bessel van der Kolk wrote a book, The Body Keeps the Score.
Oh my gosh, so that book comes up so much in this in these RFRX shows.
It's such an important title, and it's such an important concept, because I can deconstruct in my mind, okay, no, sex is good. And I actually really like sex. And I either want to have an orgasm, or I want to connect with a partner in this way, or, you know, maybe I have had an orgasm, I want more, but, you know, but the body keeps the score. The body keeps that freeze in our body. So a trauma response is either fight, flight, or freeze. Well, if the message is, you know, and that's an evolutionary response to protect ourselves. When we feel threatened, when we feel unsafe, we have three options to try and keep ourselves safe. But if the message is about our body, my body's evil, pleasure's bad. If it's about me, I can't fight my body. I mean, I guess I could self-harm. I can't flee or run from my body. I guess I could disassociate. I can freeze in my body.
That's what I hear. I've seen so many times, or I haven't seen it, but like I hear, like I just, when I hear people share stories about rape, they freeze. They just freeze. And then afterwards I hear like, well, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you try and get out of this? And again, that goes back to blaming the victim. But I always heard fight or flight, but I'd never heard fight, flight, or freeze. And oh my gosh, thank you.
Yeah. And there's a new one. I'm not sure how much research is behind it, but I anecdotally have seen it in session with people and heard about it, you know, in their experience. It's fawn. So this idea to, we see it a lot in intimate partner violence, actually. So vulva owners who endure intimate partner violence also report having the best sex of their life after a domestic violence incident, where they're fawning, where they are appeasing, because they're trying to keep themselves safe. If I can just make this person happy, if I can just mitigate the harm, what I'm going to do, whatever I'm going to do to make myself safe. And that is your body doing what it's supposed to do to reduce harm.
Wow.
And it's so if we're not trauma informed, if we don't understand how we react to these things, then it's going to be really confusing for people that don't understand these reactions.
Well, and it sounds like that fits right into the narrative from the purity messaging about women submitting to their husbands, or, you know, doing whatever they have to do to, you know, suffer like Christ or whatever it is for the male benefit. It really seems to come right out of that same kind of thought process.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty patriarchal.
Yeah.
It's pretty nasty. Yeah.
And if the whole idea is like women have to agree to submit to whenever a man wants to have sex with them, then it can't be called rape because it's was already agreed upon that this is always going to be consensual. And so I would imagine then, like if a woman was in that kind of situation, it would be very tough for her. And I'm talking from a male perspective, so I may be full of shit, but it may be really tough for her to even come to grips that this actually was raped. Is that, am I off or?
No, that's 100% on point. Absolutely. It's 100% on point. And it's reinforced by this concept to be Christ-like is to suffer. Yeah. So there's almost like this resiliency built for pain, for physical pain. We see this in just religious trauma in general, where emotional distress is ignored, physical distress is ignored. You know, children are not brought to medical professionals because we're going to believe in God to heal you. You know, so it's almost like there's this mind-body disconnection. We don't know. We build all this resilience to pain because that's normal. And we ignore pleasure because that could lead us down a path of temptation and, you know, bad things and devil stuff. So there's this mind-body disconnection. We don't know how to listen to our bodies and say, no, don't like this. Mm-mm, not for me. Or, like that. Give me more of that. You know, we lose that ability with religious trauma and with these purity core concepts. And we lose that ability emotionally. We ignore difficult emotions. There's this radical acceptance of joy and, you know, kindness and all these like wonderful emotions. And we also ignore physical sensations in our body that are super important pieces of information about things that are going bad for us and things that are very good for us.
You know, that's a great point that, you know, people might not have learned to think about or listen to what their body was telling them. Are there some ways like that you could recommend? How could somebody know if they were, you know, affected by purity culture negatively and might be experiencing mm-hmm. some impact on their sex life or their enjoyment? Mm-hmm. What might be some ways somebody could know if that was happening to them?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways that it can surface in terms of symptoms. I kind of like to look at it through a psychological, biological, and social framework. And we're kind of touching on some of these things already. So it's a perfect question to kind of lead me there. This, again, from a biological perspective, there's this body disconnection. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer listening to painful wow. sensations, pleasurable sensations in my body or emotions in my body and what that could mean. And that comes from decades of hearing you can't trust your body and you must decrease and God must increase. So there's also this kind of dissociation to not know what feels good and to not know what feels bad, which, you know, disassociation is kind of what Eric was talking about when women likely just freeze when they may be raped. And then there's also, so that's the kind of body disconnection piece. And then there's a hyper arousal the kind of opposite spectrum with the biological impacts where there might be a real high sensitivity to being touched, like an oversensitivity to it. It can be like, you know, kind of creating that panic in the body to being touched and not being comfortable with that intimate connection through touch.
It sounds like the body's keeping the score. And
mm-hmm. Exactly. Other physical consequences, you know, some terms here, vaginismus happens. So vaginismus is a mental health disorder. It's not it's not something you can go to OBGYN necessarily and get fixed. Most of them will send you to counseling. So vaginismus is when your vagina essentially cramps up and freezes on you and you cannot have intercourse. Like even if you want to in your mind, you want to have intercourse, your body freezes up. And that's a reaction that we see in the body.
What's that called again?
Vaginismus.
Vaginismus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Freeze in the body during sex. We just kind of freeze up. I've seen erectile dysfunction happen where, you know, assigned males at birth have been told that sex is bad for so long and then they get the opportunity to have sex and then their body doesn't respond. Low desire happens and pain during sex. These biological outcomes of purity culture.
So the vaginismus and sometimes erectile dysfunction can be mental things, something that maybe a pill won't necessarily solve, but a mental health professional who was kind of experienced.
Okay. I will say that if you experience erectile dysfunction, please get your heart checked out because it could be a heart condition, but oftentimes it's a mental block. I was in my last annual visit, I went and saw my OBGYN and I asked her, I was like, so what do you recommend for vulva owners who have low desire or no desire or vaginismus? She says, I recommend a sex therapist. There's no pill. And the OBGYN was like, the women come in and they ask for a pill. And I was like, there isn't one.
Yeah.
You know, it's purity culture.
Well, and that must be so difficult as well. I can say that it is, speaking from experience. I actually did experience that. But you know, the next step is if you are suffering from something like that, and then you've been told your whole life, you know, not only that sex is bad, sex is evil, but also, you know, sex therapy is probably not something that's considered in a positive light in purity culture. What should people do if you know, they're feeling embarrassed or hesitant to even bring these issues up, or or ashamed to even talk about it? Is that something that happens a lot for people, where it's a barrier for them to even get care in the first place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm on the other end, where people actually built up the courage to give me a call. So I don't necessarily see it as much on the other end. But yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of stigma still around getting help. And I think that's what I love about recovering from religion's community groups, because it's a nice, like, easing your way in to talk about this stuff. If you can come in anonymously, turn off your camera and just listen, you can hear other people talking about it, and it builds some of that courage. Okay, other people are struggling with this. I'm not the only one. And maybe it is okay to talk about it. Maybe it is okay to get help. And so that's one of the reasons why I volunteer for recovering from religion, because I believe in it so much. But yeah, lots of toxic shame that goes into the psychological impacts of purity culture. We have lots of toxic shame. We feel like it must be our fault, or there's something wrong with us or our bodies, you know, because we've been told that our bodies are wrong all along. So of course we're going to think it's something wrong with us and not something wrong with the messages that we internalize.
Yeah, that's been something, like, not listening to my body is something that's been really hard to kind of get through. If we can maybe back up a little bit, how did some of this purity culture manifest in let's say Christianity? What would be, we saw Glenda's abstinence card. What would be some other things that would indicate that a person was exposed or had purity culture pushed on them or something like that?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so we did talk about some of the political stuff that was happening and all the funding, but there was two pivotal movements in the evangelical church that happened and in the 80s and 90s, and one was that True Love Waits movement that was started by the Southern Baptist Church. And so these were large retreats or gatherings. Lots of teenagers gathered to save themselves for marriage, sign those pledge cards, have those purity rings, apparently do purity balls. So that was a really big purity balls? Yes.
I mean, is it shaving them?
Purity.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I can probably cut that out.
Out. That is beautiful.
We are talking about sex, but purity balls were dances. That,
oh, okay.
Okay, so let me collect myself. Goodness. So I've never actually met somebody that's gone to one of these, but I've heard about them. So father, instead of going to your dance, you know, to your homecoming or something at school, instead of doing that, you would go with your father, likely in a white dress, to a purity ball, where you would commit your body, your sexuality, your purity to God and to your future husband underneath your father's, you know, approval. Because of course, men, fathers are the head of the household, and they sort of own you, if you will, and so they give you away to your future husband. So these purity balls were sort of that stand-in of that chastity, self-discipline, purity culture message, where, you know, it's that, I imagine they happen around 13 to 15 years old. So that's what a purity ball was. So all of this was happening in the evangelical church. And then in 1997, a young man named Joshua Harris wrote a book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, which I unfortunately read myself when I was probably about 17, 16, maybe. So he was a young man, you know, without any training or any education on the topic, who, you know, likely grew up in the evangelical church and became a pastor of a mega church himself at some point. And he decided to write a book about kissing, dating goodbye, and encouraging the courtship model, even to where, you know, many people then didn't kiss until their wedding day. And so there was this overemphasis on sort of when or if you were interested in somebody, it's likely that that's going to end up in marriage. And so there's a lot of parental involvement. There's a lot of supervision during dates or the courtships. And then ultimately it's like you get married and then you're off on your own. So very, very confusing book. And here's where I'll give a little personal anecdote. So I read the book. I totally gobbled that shit up. I'm just going to say it. I gobbled it up. And so I was under the impression that it must mean that I'm going to marry my best friend, because I can't date, I can't kiss somebody, I can't flirt, I can't sit too close to a boy. And so I must need to become best friends with somebody, and then that will be my husband someday. And so I was 20 years old when my first proposal happened. It was my best friend, who I really cared deeply for as a friend. And I thought, okay, here it is. Here's my proposal. Here's my best friend. This is all working out. And then after we got, you know, engaged, I had my first kiss at 20 years old. Wow. And I couldn't figure out why those romantic feelings weren't coming. Like, why this sort of, you know, attraction wasn't coming. Like, where... I thought it was very, very confusing for me. And I totally gobbled up this message, and it was really harmful for everyone else and that I've talked to that read it. And he has since sort of renounced the message. He's no longer a pastor. He's actually come out as, I don't know if he's full out apologized for it, but he's basically renounced the book and said that it was a harmful message. So those are some of the movements that were happening at the time.
I do remember, I was 14, 13 years old or something, and the youth pastor brought some speaker in and kind of talked to us about abstinence. And at the end of it, had us all sign this abstinence card. I remember it was blue, and then they did a shitty job laminating each one of them. And I carried around in my Velcro wallet for a long time. And then there was a day where I accidentally left my pocket and the wallet in my pocket, and the whole thing got washed. And I was like so heartbroken, like, oh, fuck, I didn't say fuck at the time, obviously, but oh, crap, I've broken my promise to whomever, or my future wife or something like that. I got over it, obviously, but yeah. It kind of screwed me over for a while, that whole this whole concept. And then I also heard a lot about purity rings, like when folks or when girls would I was kind of raised in a somewhat affluent town, and the girls would go to this jewelry store and spend a lot of money on these purity rings, and they would always come to school or church and kind of show it off. It felt very debutante, or like, I don't know, it just felt like they were missing the point or something. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very like externalizing value in a way too, like this externalization that we do so much in religion, this pledge card, like how awful it was for you when you like had lost it or it got damaged or something. And Kara and I were talking about earlier before we started the recording about our purity rings, and we have no idea where they are now, but they were like a really big deal. And, you know, my family, you know, didn't have a whole lot of money growing up, but we somehow had money for a Black Hills Gold purity ring when I was 13, right?
And Black Hills, like, Gold?
Black what Hills is, Gold.
What does that mean?
Oh, this is like the type of gold, I think, in the Dakotas somewhere.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, so.
It almost seemed like the more they spent on this ring, the more they meant it or something?
Yeah. It's like your wedding ring to Jesus, basically. Yes. Which is super creepy also.
Yeah,
creepy.
Yeah.
We want to get into that. But I mean, you are basically getting an engagement ring to God,
yeah,
sort of.
Yeah, and then if you do kiss somebody or have sex before marriage, you have cheated
on yeah. God,
Jesus, on yeah. God, or
and your future
spouse.
Husband or partner.
Yes, and then we haven't talked about this. This is a really big piece of purity culture. You're sort of damaged goods. There's so many analogies in purity culture. Like, you don't want to, vulva owners would be told, you don't want to be a chewed up piece of gum for your future husband, or, mm-hmm. you know, the rose analogy. Every time you know, kiss a boy or have sex, you lose a petal, you lose a piece of yourself.
Oh my gosh.
And
so
it's like this finite sense of sexuality and eroticism that you're all of a sudden like damaged and less than and less pure and less valuable to God and to somebody else. Again, externalizing worth, externalizing value, instead of really innately having that.
Yeah, I remember learning that even, like you said, that every time you had sex, it would like tear a piece of your soul away and it would be stuck to that other person, because the Bible says that when a husband and wife come together, which is the only time sex can happen apparently, they become one flesh. And so if you separate from that person, then, you know, it's not a clean tear, you know, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid, and some of you is stuck to them and some of them is stuck mm-hmm. to you, and you do that a bunch of times, and yeah. it's like the 1990s version of making a horcrux or something. But I was really scared of, like, I don't want to lose parts of my soul, I don't want to yeah. become evil.
Yeah, absolutely, this weird like tethering bonding thing, all these odd analogies. Yeah,
yeah. Totally. Which it didn't that. Make sense to me either, because I thought, okay, if the point is that you lose the piece of your soul after having had sex with the person, like, why does that not happen if you're married to that person? Like, I mean, when does the tearing happen? Right. It's like, it doesn't really make sense, mm-hmm. but that didn't matter apparently.
Yeah. It doesn't point. Matter, because when you ask questions, what is that? You're lacking faith. Right?
Yeah.
So to ask questions, to doubt, to challenge the status quo is to lack faith. And that's part of how this and other religiously traumatizing concepts are maintained, these thought stopping techniques, where, mm-hmm. you know, who I have this written down because I figured this would come up, you know, 1 John 4:6, whoever knows God listens to us, and he who is not of God does not listen to us. By this we know who the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. So here we have it. There's no question or doubt that cannot be answered within the system itself, this closed system logic. So when you make the assumption we are right and the world is wrong, the proof of being in the truth is listening to us being leadership or the Bible or your father, whoever it is. And the proof of listening or of error rather is listening to the world. So I'm sure like many people have, Kara, like you, some like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense, or some questions or some skepticism or some doubts, but like to ask questions or to even ask for information, you know, mm-hmm. what's a condom, you know, like what's an STD, you know, what are these things, like what's masturbation, like even to ask is like stigmatized or shamed or, you know, met with silence, or, oh, we don't talk about that, you know, you'll learn about that later, or you don't need to know anything about that.
Go ahead, Eric.
One of the things I remember in high school was, in myself included, a lot of us guys, or even some of the gals would look down on women who or girls who we thought were loose or thought would sleep with anybody, and mm-hmm. We didn't think much of them, and like they were used up, and if you slept with them, then you're sleeping with everybody that they've slept with in the past. From the discussion here, that it may not be, but it sounds like a lot of that is tied to the purity culture and how we kind of viewed mm-hmm. sex, as just this denigrating the individuals who wanted to experience pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. I just read a dissertation called The Moral Assumptions of in Sex Education in the US. And he really tied slut shaming to purity culture. And how, you know, it's weird. It's like that assumption, like women don't want sex, men want it all the time. It really does run deep in terms of how we then respond to women who are, you know, erotic and sexual and like having sex and aren't afraid, you know, to be outward about it. And then there's sort of this slut shaming that happens because we've digested these concepts. And it also kind of reminds me, I'm not sure how we're doing on time, because I also want to talk about, you know, recovery and all that kind of stuff. But another core concept in purity culture is complementarianism, where, you know, the husband is the head of the household and the woman is submissive and servant, or just, you know, supportive, however you want to say it. And so then, so long as everybody assumes their roles, you know, the man is outwardly a leader, his family's in line because of the way that he runs his household, and the woman supports him and never questions him and really honors his will. So long as everybody knows their role, then there's no problems in the marriage. That's what complementarianism is. And that also kind of leads to the church, so that everybody knows their role in the church, you know, men in leadership and women more in those servant, quiet, modest roles, there should be no problems in the church. And so when there is problems in marriages or problems in the church, the automatic assumption is there must be something wrong with the roles or people living up their roles. And that's really shaming for both sides, because, you know, if you're a vulva owner and you're an entrepreneurial and you're opinionated like I am, then that's really shaming for folks like me, you know. And same with assigned males at birth, you know, if they are kind of more go with the flow and just hang out or just whatever, then that's going to be really difficult for them too. So complementarianism is kind of a nuanced shaming of just people's personalities too, which also is tied to a lot of social impacts, where the social impacts being that we don't have very good boundaries. Folks that grew up in this culture, we don't really understand that privacy is important. Privacy is sort of seen as deceitful. And we have all these accountability groups and these confession groups and all this stuff. And we also, and that has to do with kind of this complementarianism. And it also has to do with the negative impacts of lack of conflict management skills.
So wait, there's accountability groups for this stuff?
Oh, yeah.
What? Yeah. What does that look like? Like, oh, like, I show up. No, I didn't have sex this week. All right, see ya. What is that?
Yeah, so like, I'm surprised. Okay, yeah. So accountability groups, like in youth groups, the boys would sort of be sequestered and they would just confess if they had looked at any sexually stimulating material or masturbated that week. And then they would have a chance to confess that and, you know, be prayed over and like, okay, brother, you know, we hope you have a better week this week. And and then like, and even like more recent sort of having programs on your computer that block sexually stimulating material. And anytime you take down the block or anytime you access something, a message goes to your accountability partner. Like they get an email that you had taken down the block to try and maintain.
Accountability partners?
Yeah. And I had an accountability partner. I don't think we ever called this person that, but I was, you know, before I had left the church, I was single, unmarried. I was a single mom at the time. And so the elders in the church really like were trying to get me sort of married, I guess you will, or like paired with somebody. And so they sort of tied me with this married woman who was giving, she had access to my email account and would read emails that came from like people I was dating, and she would analyze them and tell me how to respond and stuff like that. Yeah.
It's almost a surprise that you were single.
Well, yeah. And so that was like, and I'm going to tie this is really important. I'm going to tie this back into sort of the body keeps the score, because so obviously I figured out that was not okay, that was a little intrusive. Again, going back to these privacy, you know, needs for privacy and lack of having boundaries and privacy in these settings. So I left the church. I eventually deconstructed. I hadn't seen this woman in years. And here I'm like, appear to be sort of, you know, and now I'm married, I appear to be like in more of a nuclear-ish family, although it's a blended family. And I've totally deconstructed this stuff. I no longer believe it. I'm no longer religious. And I'm at Trader Joe's and I run into her and I almost have a panic attack. Like I felt like I'm doing something wrong or I'm like, I'm not okay. You know, I saw this woman who used to have access to my email, who was telling me how to respond, how to be pure, how to be, you know, modest and how to go about dating. And the body had kept the score in that. And so I was like, okay, my religious trauma isn't fully integrated yet because I just almost had a panic attack seeing her, feeling like I was doing something wrong when here I'm just shopping with my husband for groceries, right?
Wow. You know, that is just so incredible that even years later, they can make you feel like you're doing something wrong, even when you weren't even doing anything. Aside from the fact that you didn't even buy into that anymore. But I mean, it's like set up to where everyone has to fail. No one will succeed at this purity game.
Yeah. Exactly. By all means, I could sort of pass if I wanted to. You know, I'm heterosexual, I'm cisgender, I'm married, I have two kids. I could pass in this culture if I wanted. Obviously, I don't want to. But even then, there's that trauma. There's that trauma response years and years later.
Oh, that's terrible. Could you talk a little bit more about, you talked about deconstructing. Could you unpack that a little bit, like whether it's what that looked like for you or just kind of in general, how people might go through that process of coming out of that?
Yeah, I think deconstruction is very individualized for every person. You know, when I think about deconstructing, I think about you take down a block at a time. You know, we're addressing some really harmful messages about sexuality. And by just talking about them, I imagine some people are like, oh yeah, I heard that. That's bullshit, right? They're probably wanting to take those pieces down. And so deconstruction is sort of like a piece by piece acknowledging what sort of harmful messages might have come your way and really addressing, do I still believe this? Is this something that I believe in or something that I subscribe to? Or is this just something that was told to me? And sort of piece by piece taking that down. And so that can be about religion. It can be about purity culture. It can be about really any harmful beliefs that we've developed in our family of origins as well.
Oh.
And then reconstruction, you know, some people reconstruct their religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs. You know, I always thought that maybe I personally would, but I kind of deconstructed and stayed deconstructed. haven't really
you know,
built anything back up.
I've seen that recently. I think some people might have been talking about that in the chat too, but I saw as I was, you know, getting ready for this episode, I noticed on YouTube there's some episodes of like not Josh McDowell, his son, doing a podcast talking about, you know, what purity culture got right and, you know, how we can, you know, kind of reclaim some of this. What do you think about that? About people kind of trying to take pieces of it and salvage it like it's going to work okay.
That's a tough one for me. I can't do that. And maybe, you know, I have heard that. I've heard that, well, you know, it reduces teen pregnancy, you know, these period, you know, waiting for marriage, or it reduces STI spread. Well, the truth is that it actually doesn't. In the Netherlands and Denmark, they start teaching about body parts and consent at 4 and 5 years old. And they have the lowest rates of STI and teen pregnancies anywhere. You know, so it's almost like, you know, the more taboo it is, the less we talk about it, the more likely it's gonna happen. Where people in the Netherlands also wait longer. They sort of put a little bit more emphasis or intention or like substance behind it when they do make the decision to be sexual and to share that with a partner. And so I have a hard time with that for that reason. Mm-hmm. And the other reason I have a hard time with that is because it's so heteronormative and it shames. And there's all these microassaults and microaggressions towards the LGBTQ community. And I just don't see any good in it. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on top of all that, it's boring.
No super redeeming boring qualities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense to me. It's just, it's all built up with, you know, all of those narratives, like you were talking about at the beginning, it sounds like. I mean, how do you take something salvageable out of, you know, we're basing this in patriarchy and misogyny and anti-LGBT everything and shaming everyone and dissociate from your body. I mean, what is the good messaging? So what would reconstruction look like then if people totally dump that?
Like reconstructing like faith or sexuality or?
I guess sexuality.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a really big proponent for therapy. Obviously I'm a therapist, but reconstructing ones that I kind of have this in community, bibliotherapy, mindfulness, and therapy is kind of what, where I can see pieces of reconstruction can happen. So just as we start out the meeting, community, talking about these harmful effects, having a safe place to talk about it. So Dr. Teen Sellers, she wrote the book Sex, God, and the Conservative Church. And she has this wonderful quote about how important support groups are. And she says, shame cannot live in the presence of love and begins to fade in the absence of judgment. So we gotta take that shame away. And we do that in community. We do that in the presence of love, and we do that in the absence of judgment. So we find groups like we are here now where we can do just that. And recovering from religious support groups obviously is a great outlet for that. Bibliotherapy, I love the book Pure. We talked about that by Linda K. Klein. Come As You Are is an excellent book by Emily Nagoski. It covers like all the recent sexual health research and really makes it really applicable to folks who have endured negative negative impacts of purity culture. And I also really like the book Becoming Safely Embodied. We talked about how body keeps the score, so we need to have tools and things to make ourselves feel safely embodied. And all of these things are going to be in the resources list that I sent over to Eric, and Eric will have tagged with this meeting.
Yeah.
One
of the poll questions was, do you feel that purity culture has affected your life in any way? And from our discussion here, if you're an American citizen, it seems to have been literally written into law. And so it affects everybody who was a citizen in the U.S. And I'm sure that many other countries have similar purity, chastity bills too. Is that accurate?
I don't really know apart from the U.S. I mean, I'm sure there are other countries that do, but I don't know any off the top of my head. But yeah, there's still, even today, there's still more states that emphasize abstinent education, sex education than not. More states that do than don't.
And like what we saw from Glenda's abstinence card, it is even has roots in the public school system as well. So this is pervasive. And from this discussion, I'm getting the sense that it's pretty darn harmful too, and restricts our own freedoms and and curiosity as well.
Yeah.
So, where would we go from here? Let's say I identified I've been fucked up by a purity culture. I'm struggling with being okay with sex. I'm struggling with all of these things I was exposed to in the past with when it comes to purity culture. Where could I go? You had mentioned a therapist. With that sounds great. Do you have any other recommendations?
Yeah, I also have kind of some tips on what type of therapist to search for too, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
So, okay.
A pastor, right? You like go seek out your pastor. Yeah.
Christian counseling.
Please don't do that, please. Yeah, we didn't even talk about conversion therapy. Good God, it's become illegal in that, like, churches can still do it, but under the licensing boards, like, no mental health professional in several states now cannot do conversion therapy, which is a really great thing. But what I was going to say is, with therapists, it can be really helpful. You know, obviously the Secular Therapy Project has done a lot of the work for us in terms of finding a therapist who legitimizes the term religious trauma and uses an evidence-based practice. Some other places you might go are the LGBTQ affirmative therapist guilds. A lot of cities have their own guilds that are queer affirming. And, you know, any ASEC certified sex therapist can be really helpful as well. So these people are going to really have the credentialing you're going to need to address some of these residual trauma. The other thing that I think is really transformative for me is a therapist who has at least integrated person-centered into their approach. So person-centered really diffuses that power differential in between therapist and client. So, you know, what does this feel like? You know, this feels like religion, right? Where we have our purity culture, yeah. We have like a head of the household, or we have a pastor telling us how we should live our lives, right? And so person-centered does this. Person-centered diffuses that power differential. And it's so important for us to, who've survived these messages, to get back in touch with ourselves and to know that we need to have connection to our voice, our opinion, our important emotions, and the large range of those emotions, our bodies, and to have an environment where we are the expert in the room about our own self is so corrective and so healing. And we find that in person-centered therapeutic approaches. So, you know, ask a therapist if they integrate person-centered at all. I think it's super transformative and helpful. And then in terms of integrating the body's trauma response, so we've deconstructed cognitively. We know we don't believe this BS anymore, but my body still panics. You know, my body still freezes. My body still reacts a certain way to the stimulus. And so any body-based trauma-informed modality, so EMDR, somatic experiencing, tapping, it's a modality I'm gonna get trained in this summer. It's really, really healing. Neurofeedback and brain spotting are all body-based therapies that help bring calm to the body, help sort of release that stress response. The stress response in your body is trying to keep you safe, from, you know, those, the hell and the fear and the terror. And so we got to do something to tell our body we're safe. And all these body-based trauma-informed modalities can have that effect.
So these are things that people could go, if they went to one of these ASEC certified therapists or counselors, they could learn this skill that they could practice at home, or this thing that they would do? Is that where they access this?
So all those body-based trauma modalities that I mentioned are all different types of training. So you can get ASEC sex certified is one sort of training or certification. You can also get EMDR certified. You can get, they're all different types of trainings that are really helpful in integrating the trauma that's held in the body. And these are all sort of, even on Psychology Today, you can kind of click and filter for some of these modalities, especially like EMDR and somatic experiencing, and find somebody who's trained in it.
Now, I'm going to go a little bit on a brief tangent, but we've been really kind of focusing on Christianity and kind of purity culture within Christianity. But I assume that Christianity doesn't hold the patent on purity culture, and the one religion that really kind of comes to mind where it's super obvious is Islam, where women are in many places required to have head coverings with just slits to look through. I think that's maybe an extreme example of what purity culture can become. Do you know of any others any other religions that might have a similar view on purity culture? just offhand?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I do know that Jehovah's Witnesses also have a real strong, like, women need to, you know.
Mormons.
Yeah, and Mormons are also very similar in this way. I'm not sure other than that. But yeah, purity culture or chastity and withholding your, you know, yourself for your future spouse or for God is not necessarily a Christian concept, to your point. It just happens to get a lot of momentum in the evangelical church in the 80s and 90s, but it's a very old concept.
Yeah. Well, Christy, this was so freaking good. Thank you so much for coming on here. Before we move on, is there anything else that you want to cover that we may not have done so far?
Yeah, there's just one thing that I think is really important for, you know, folks who are sexual assault survivors in these organizations and institutes, is this idea of sin leveling. And I just want to say that to validate the fact that, like, this is not okay that this happened, if this did happen to you, but sin leveling is this misclassification of sexual assault as equal of offense as premarital sex. So we can see in actual policy and procedure handbooks of religious institutes that their sexual misconduct section will have sort of extramarital sexual activity or premarital sex as sort of the offense. And they may not even mention sexual assault or rape. Or if they do, it's way, 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 way down at the bottom. And so this misclassification, the sin leveling, it systemically silences victims and enforces that victim blaming, so that when or if a victim actually does have the courage to come forth and say something, they're often met with those victim blaming messages. Well, what were you wearing, or what were you drinking, or, you know, or were you drinking anything, or also like questioning the story, or making it about the sex and not making it about that they were assaulted, you know? And so then the perpetrator often gets off the hook without being, without the police being notified or authorities being brought in. So that's also a really core concept that we didn't get to that I just kind of want to put in there, and that this is a really unfortunate thing that happens, and that, you know, if this happened to you, you're not alone. And a lot of people experience that, and it wasn't okay, and it wasn't your fault.
Yeah, I absolutely remember learning that kind of thing. And we did the Bill Gothard IBLP homeschool program in my home. And absolutely, there was information on, like, well, if something has happened, some things to think about, you know, were you defrauding someone? Were you being a temptress? You know, what, think about what you did that might have brought this on you. And it would turn it back around on the person, even if they were assaulted, to where, well, what led to you having this sexual encounter that you shouldn't have been involved in?
And it adds trauma to trauma, right? Mm-hmm. That, because what can really help a trauma survivor is due process, is a community coming around and saying, this wasn't okay, and we're here to protect you and support you and give you the resources you need to recover from this, and we're going to have the necessary consequences for this perpetrator. Those are all healing recovery steps for a trauma survivor. So then what happens if somebody actually does have the guts, which takes a huge amount of courage to say anything, and they're met with those messages, they often say that that was more traumatizing than the actual rape. Mm-hmm. So not okay. And, you know, we see you, we hear you, we hate that this happened to you, and it's not okay.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that type of behavior would allow the people sort of to sweep the whole situation under the rug and still sleep okay at night.
Yeah.
With a clear conscience.
That's
scary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Well, Christy, again, thank you so, so much. We have quite a few questions here. We're going to probably have to trim them down for time. But folks, Christy has supplied us with a Google Doc that is filled with incredible resources, books and websites and all sorts of stuff, resources for deconstructing the faith, resources, all sorts of great stuff. And so I'm going to go ahead and share the link to that Google Doc. And while I do that, Kara, would you mind starting off with the first question?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we do have quite a few, so we'll just get through as many as we can. Some people were asking, I'll kind of combine these two questions. When did purity culture start and end, and how is it being rebranded today? Has it ended, or are we still seeing it in sort of disguise or a rebranded fashion?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So again, like purity is, or chastity is an old concept. It's not a new one. It just happened to kind of get branded as purity culture in, I'd say, the 80s and 90s, especially. Although mm-hmm. Glenda had her card from 2004. So I mean, it's still happening in the early 2000s, you know. And even today, again, we're still seeing that more states than not are emphasizing abstinent-only education over actual sex education. So I think it's, you know, it's still happening. I don't know so much that it's rebranded itself as maybe taken more softer approach. I can't really speak to that as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll have to
see. I definitely think in more like rural places, it's still happening. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we still had some purity balls, purity rings, and those victim blaming messages happening.
Oh, absolutely. I've got people in my family that are still on board with this. So
mm-hmm. I'll be honest. Yeah. I'm not going to think the same about purity balls again. So
I'm not either.
It's making a horrible thing a little bit more bearable. But, the next question we have, seriously, folks, the next question we have is, you know, science has provided us an amazing thing to free women up to kind of have sex and explore their bodies without the reduced risk of getting pregnant. How does the pill kind of fit into the whole purity culture ideal? Like, is it even a part of it?
Hmm. You know, I couldn't say. I mean, it certainly has freed up women to be more able to explore themselves sexually and enjoy sex more so. I know that. I'm not sure how it may have or not have impacted the purity culture concepts that we're talking about. I'm happy for anyone else to chime in any of their thoughts on that question.
Well, I'm kind of thinking like the pill and condoms are somewhat like birth control is mm-hmm. is in that same category. When I was a kid going through it, I don't recall how they addressed birth control at all. Especially, I would imagine that they kind of pointed out all of the flaws and all of the quote unquote damage that it could do. But in order to make the argument that abstinence was the best and only thing that worked 100%, if you've never heard that, if you have heard that abstinence works 100%, then you've been exposed to purity culture.
Yeah. I remember actually receiving a book also that was, I guess, part of purity culture when I got engaged as a teenager, that talks not only about how, you know, you shouldn't be on the pill before you're married because you're not having sex, but also after you're married, it was this convoluted explanation about how, since women already don't like sex, it can decrease your sex drive even more and will make it more difficult for you to enjoy sex with your husband. So don't get on it at all. I don't know if that was part of, you know, maybe some other narrative about have as many children as you can or what was happening there, but... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got that message in my version of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so also on that topic, as far as, you know, some of the biological consequences that you mentioned, someone else was asking specifically about resources to do with vaginismus mm-hmm. or those kinds of things. Is that something that they would also take up with one of these counselors or therapists that you mentioned, or is there maybe some other place they should go for that?
Yeah, definitely a certified sex therapist, for sure, will have training and know how to help folks with that. Yeah, great question.
Good to know. Okay, so don't just go to your GP and expect to be treated immediately.
No, they probably don't. I mean, get it checked out for sure, because there could be something else biologically going on. You want to always rule that out, but vaginismus is usually a mental health concern that happens oftentimes through women have, vulva owners have endured these heavy religious messages throughout their adolescence, and their body is just not responding. So it's a mental health disorder.
Okay, that's good to know.
We've got another question here. And what are your thoughts on, like, within purity culture, it becomes, we're almost trained to not tell the difference between this feeling of love and then and sex. Like, the two become incredibly intertwined. Like, if you love someone, then or you can only love someone you have sex with, or something like that. What are your thoughts? Are these connected to the purity culture?
Yeah, probably, absolutely. I mean, where my mind goes is that, you know, the whole spectrum of asexual, demisexual, and sexual, you know, for a lot of us, like, we don't need to be emotionally connected or have loving feelings or feel emotionally safe with someone to want to have sex and to want to be erotic and want to be playful. And that's all good and fine. You know, is it consensual? Are we safe? Are we practicing sexual health practices? Then great. You know, are we being honest and open with what our sexual health practices are? Then awesome. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But yeah, I think, like, this sort of, it reminds me of this tethering idea that Kara was highlighting earlier, that, like, sex sort of bonds you to someone, or you need to be married or in love with them, and only then is it okay. And you know, it doesn't have to be that. Some people are just sexual and they enjoy being polysexual and maybe monoromantic with, yeah, my cat's here. Sorry. I try to keep him away as long as possible.
Looks like the lemur from Madagascar or something like that. All I see is his tail sticking up.
Just his tail. That's all that's here.
Does the cat have anything it wants to say?
Probably. I don't know if you can hear his purring, but, like,
it's a purity tail.
It's a... You know, some people are monoromantic and polysexual, you know, and if we are having sexual health conversations, if we're having frank conversations and keeping ourselves safe, and you want to do that, that's awesome. And that's a part of exploring your eroticism and your sexuality. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's part of, I think, part of that deconstruction process of taking down some of these harmful beliefs that to love someone is to have sex with them, or to have sex with someone is to love them. It's like this overemphasis on sex either way. And some people are asexual and they are heavily committed and heavily in love with a partner, but they could go with or without sex. There's nothing wrong with that, you know? And then we have demis. We got demisexuals who we need to feel emotionally safe and we need to feel bonded to access our erotic self with someone. So let's just not yuck each other's yum and we'll all be fine.
I love it. It sounds like sex can be like tennis. You just play a game with a partner, or, you know, more than one. It could be like soccer or something like that, a whole group sport.
And it doesn't have
to be tied to love. That's
It absolutely doesn't. No, if we don't want it to, let's just have frank, open sexual health conversations and keep each other safe. Let's get tested. Let's share those results. Let's let each other know when partners come in and out, and let's take care of each other and let's have fun.
Sounds like a brilliant way to reduce STIs and be healthy, and even reduce pregnancies and abortions, for crying out loud. That's like, the knowledge could be power. That sounds fantastic.
The poly community prides themselves in having very frank, mature, open conversations about sexual health, to the point where we are being really open with who we are with and who we are not with, and updating each other on our screenings, you know, and it's fun. Like, it can be fun. It can be healthy. It can be lovely with the right supports and the right people and the right conversations.
Well, this has been so useful. These, I think that some of the things you're talking about are relevant to lots and lots and lots of people. We have so many questions. And this one I have is actually coming from, what about for people who are already clinicians or therapists or counselors that want to get better at working with clients on these kinds of issues? Are there classes or certifications that people can go to learn about how to help people with this?
I'm so glad this question was asked. So my colleague, Amy Congdon, and I have developed a CEU called Understanding and Treating Religious Trauma, the Negative Impacts of Purity Culture. And we have a recording of it. We are going to sort of package it sometime this fall and make it available to sell for folks so that they can learn more about it. Also, I believe that I think the Religious Trauma Institute is starting to build up a bunch of trainings too for mental health professionals on various religious trauma. And then of course, CORT, we just had the conference on religious trauma last month. That was highly helpful and informative. So get on top of those CORT emails. Hopefully we have that annually. And so there's lots of trainings out there for therapists. So if you want to email me or contact me, my website will be tagged to this presentation, and I can give you more information on where to get those trainings.
Oh, fantastic. I know there is such a need for this. So that is wonderful to hear that you're doing so much work on that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Kristy, we've run out of time for any more additional questions. And thank you again so much. Like I said, and I'll be repeating myself, this was amazing. It was a little scary for me to revisit some of this stuff, but you helped walk me through how to identify it and kind of work through it. And honestly, I think I need to take your advice and go find a therapist who specializes in these kinds of things. So thank you. Thanks for encouraging us to do that.
This has been an honor and a pleasure, and I appreciate all the questions and the discussion style. It's just so helpful, I think, to continue to talk about this and get people reducing that shame.
Yeah. Yes. Looking through the chat as watching it as this whole discussion was going, you have made a big impact and kind of gave words and validity to what people have experienced in the past and what people are going through now. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you've made a big impact on these folks, and I know you made a big impact on me personally. So thank you again for like the 40th time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much, Kristy. We're so glad you were able to come. This has been fantastic. I am definitely going to check out all of those resources you mentioned. I cannot wait. This is super relevant to so many of us. So I am so glad you were here.
Glad to hear it.
Folks, I'm going to go ahead and drop the resource, the link to the resource document in the chats again, and also link to Kristy's website. And while I do that, Kara, why don't you tell us what's coming up next week? Because we just seem to keep coming up with more and more people who want to talk to us about awesome stuff.
Yes, I am really excited about next week's as well. We're going to be kind of continuing on a theme with David Teachout is going to talk about sacred harm, abuse within religious fundamentalism. And kind of the point of this talk is that experiencing abuse is already difficult, obviously, yet it can be made more so when systems in place to support your growth are themselves the source of the abuse. The social relationship embodied as religious ideology is powerful because it connects us to one another and provides a structure for meaning and purpose and ethics for one's life. So we'll look at how this structure can be and is used to undermine the building of self-worth, perpetuating a moral injury form of abuse, and how to move through and beyond beyond it with resiliency. So definitely look forward to that. That's next Monday, same time, same place.
We've had David on the show before. I think this will be his third time as a guest.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to hear about this one too. It just sounds really interesting and a great follow-up to what we heard about today. So definitely looking forward to it. And as always, all of the previous recordings can be found on our YouTube channel, and this one will go up there as well. So in case you came in late or you want to go back and listen, I know I probably do, to hear all of those resources again. So that'll be up there on the YouTube channel, Recovering from Religion. And then again, topical inquiries, questions, comments, suggestions can be sent via email to rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. And don't forget to visit our blog at medium.com/excommunications or our podcast at recoveringfromreligion.org/podcast.
Also, folks, if you can, you can support us in all sorts of ways. You can support us by donating. You can support us by volunteering, but you can also support us by interacting, liking, following, blah, 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 all of that social media stuff. It really, really helps. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on TikTok. And I'm going to go ahead and dump those links, because I'm a great dumper, into the chat there. But if you really would like to see more of this stuff, then please help us by following and interacting and liking and all that other fun stuff with social media. In addition to that, we've got a newsletter that goes out every so often, and usually about every week, and it talks about what's some news with RFR. It talks about the resources that are on the previous RFRX. So like, I think this week's letter will have resources for this talk. It also will have what videos have been published on our YouTube channel and what articles have been published on our blog. If you want to sign up for the newsletter, which I recommend you do, you can follow the link in the chat or in the link of the YouTube description as well. I'm going to bring on our executive director, Gail Jordan, to kind of give her closing thoughts. Gail, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here again. I just love seeing everyone's face. You all have heard me do this so many times, you can do it yourself. I can't possibly begin to mention everything that's been dropped in the chat, all of the programs that we have going. You can see more information about them, but I do want to mention this one thing. As you have watched tonight, you've seen some folks that are kind of the face of RFRX. You've seen Eric and Kara do a wonderful job. Behind the scenes, you have our troll smashers. You've heard us talk about that. Everybody Wave, who was a troll smasher, that's Helen and Glenda and Rob, and may even been some other folks. Thank you guys. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. We mentioned that these videos will go up on YouTube. We mentioned the podcast. We mentioned the blog. There is a heck of a lot going on at Recovering from Religion. And I want to tell you something. It's as much fun as it looks like it is. If you want to be part of this big, loving family, we would love to have you. There's a job for everyone. If you have some time to give, if you see the impact that religion has on the lives of folks who might need a little bit of help, a little bit of support, a little bit of space as they unpack all of the baggage, we'd love to have you part of the team. If that means to you that you've got some time to give, we'd love to have for you to go visit the Recovering from Religion website and click on the volunteer tab. But being part of the family might mean to you at this point in your life, giving a donation, becoming a monthly donor. That's awesome too. Everybody that you see here are volunteers. We have scores of volunteers behind the scenes. There are folks having chats right now behind the scenes. There's folks that are answering phone calls. Sometimes they're heavy, sometimes they're not, but it takes all of us working together to get this ship going in the right direction so that we can help people as they begin to experience those doubts and up to and including leaving the religion of their childhood, the faith of their family. Thank you for attending. Christy, I still see you may have your camera off, and if you're still with us and if you can hear me, thank you so much for an unbelievably important presentation. I believe everybody that was in the room got something out of this tonight. Even if we weren't part of it, we can see the impact of purity culture in our society and certainly in our lives if we have experienced that kind of thing. Thank you again for coming. I hope you'll stay for the social hour. It's the best time ever. It'll give you a chance. We'll unmute the microphones and you'll have a chance to actually talk to one another. We've got our social hosts. That's another group of volunteers that are hanging out with us. Our social hosts will lead us through the evening, and we hope we can accommodate you staying as long as you'd like to be able to talk through whether it's this topic or another topic related to recovering from religion. And the last thing I want to tell you is 2 years ago, we had for the first time our fall excursion. It's a weekend religion recovery getaway, so to speak. It's in the cool, serene mountains of North Carolina. It's everything that you might think it would be. It's all of the good stuff from all those retreat years back in our church days, with all of the good and none of the bad, all the campouts, none of the kumbaya, as I like to say. If you can join us, go see us at recoveringfromreligion.org. You'll find information about how to register and how to find your housing and the cost and all of those things. So give us a visit, give us a click, and we hope to see you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.